Okay, so in the world of storage, we have two areas. We have DRAM, and we have disk and flash. So DRAM is great because it's fast, and it's byte addressable, but it's volatile. And so on the other side, disk and flash are non-volatile, but they're slower, and they're only block addressable. And so the focus of this talk is on a new type of storage. And that's what we're calling byte addressable persistent RAM. And this combines the properties of both disk and RAM. And it's fast, it's byte addressable, and it's non-volatile. And so the question behind our work is, how do we build fast, reliable systems with BPRAM? And so to keep this talk grounded, there are a number of different BPRAM type of technologies. So we're going to focus on what we think is the most promising form, and that's phase change memory. And it's recently entered mass production. And so to give you a little primer on how phase change memory works, it encodes bits as resistivity. And so it takes a chalcogenide glass and then heats it up to like 600 degrees Celsius. And then it cools it. And based on how quickly or how slowly it cools it, it encodes a 0 or 1. And so the interesting things here are that its access latency is in the nanoseconds, which is much faster than disk or flash. And I also want to note that its endurance is far greater than flash. But at the same time, it's also much less than DRAM. And so write leveling is still a concern with things like phase change memory. But this is an area that many others are researching. And so we're not going to focus on that in the talk. And so in this talk, I'm going to talk about the design of a new file system, BPFS, for BPRAM. And the result of this new design is both improved performance and improved reliability for applications. So, in the design of this file system, our goal was to provide these new guarantees for applications. And one is, we want file system operations to commit atomically and in program order. The second is that we want data to become durable as soon as the cache is flushed. And so these are significant advancements beyond the file systems that we can efficiently support today. And we're able to provide these goals with a new consistency mechanism that we call short circuit shadow paging. And this will be a lot of the focus of the talk today. So there are three design principles that drive the ability for short circuit shadow paging to be able to take advantage of byte addressable persistent memory. And one is that we're able to eliminate the DRAM buffer cache instead using the CPU caches. The second is that we put BPRAM on the memory bus, where it's directly accessible from ordinary loads and stores. And then the third is that we provide atomic writes and write ordering in hardware so that software can take advantage of the properties of BPRAM. Okay, and so in the rest of this talk, I'm going to talk about the design of BPFS and how it meets these goals. And then I'll talk about hardware support that we need to add to PCs for them to be able to take advantage of BPRAM in your memory board. And then we'll evaluate these changes. So just before we take a look at the file system, let's take a look at how BPRAM fits into our PC architecture. And so here we have a picture of what we have today, where we have our CPU caches, and then going across the memory bus, we have DRAM, and then across other buses, we have hard drive and flash. And so we're putting BPRAM alongside DRAM on the memory bus, so that both BPRAM and DRAM are addressable by the CPU. And so we'll physically partition the address space into persistent and non-persistent. And just like DRAM, BPRAM will take advantage of the CPU caches to provide significant performance improvements. And for this talk, we're going to eliminate the use of disk and flash as well. Okay, so BPFS is a new file system designed for BPRAM. It guarantees that all file operations execute atomically and in program order. And despite these improved guarantees, it also offers significant performance improvements over file systems like NTFS on the same media, and is able to provide these guarantees and increase performance with short-circuit shadow paging, which is often able to make updates in place and atomically. So now let's take a look at the layout of BPFS. We have the root pointer through which the rest of the file system is accessible. It in turn points to a tree of indirect blocks, which point to the inodes for the file system. And then each inode has a root pointer for its own file that contains its indirect blocks and data blocks. And so in BPFS, like in other standard Bayesian tech file systems, we have user files that contain arbitrary data, and we have metadata files that contain directory entries and inodes. So just to keep things simple for the rest of this talk, we'll focus on looking at only one file with the root of that file and ignore the rest of the file system tree. So a question that people always have when using persistent storage is, what happens if we crash during an update? So for example here, let's say that we wanted to update both of these blocks together that are red. So if we write the first block, but then crash before we can write the second block, we've corrupted the on-disk or on-persistent image in some way. And so there are many different techniques that try to protect against these types of failures. And so on disk, we use journaling and shadow paging primarily. And I'm going to review these and then contrast them with how short-circuit shadow paging works, designed for BPRAM. So journaling is used in EXT3, EXT4, and TFS, in many other file systems. And so let's take a look at how this would work. Say that we have this file system that you can see, and we want to update blocks A and B. So before we go and write them into the file system, we're going to journal them. And only after they're committed to durable storage in the journal can we safely update them in the file system. And this atomically writes either no changes or both changes. And so this is reliable, but the drawback is that all data is written twice. And this is such a significant overhead that most file systems today do not journal user data. They only journal metadata to keep the file system consistent. So the second technique is shadow paging. And shadow paging never overwrites data in place. Instead, it always makes a copy. So here, if we want to modify blocks A and B, we'll write the contents of the new A and B to some unused blocks. Now, if we were to read from the file system at this point, we would see the old contents, because no blocks point to the new contents. So we also need to update any pointers to A and B. And so we'll write a new version of the indirect block to point to A and B, and then we'll rewrite the version of its parent, and all the way up to the tree, until eventually we rewrite the root of this tree, and that atomically switches from the old to the new contents. The drawback to shadow paging is that any change requires bubbling the writes all the way up to the root of the tree. And for small changes, in particular metadata changes, the metadata for the file system that's needed to update these bottom data changes can dwarf the cost of updating the actual data sizes. And so file systems today are able to try to make this performant only by batching up very large volumes of writes to try to amortize the cost of these updates. So short-circuit shadow paging was inspired by shadow paging, but with the optimizations that takes advantage of BPRAM to update in place wherever possible, eliminating most copies. So let's take a look at how short-circuit shadow paging works in this example. We write the new copies of A and B, and then we'll write the new indirect block that contains pointers to blocks A prime and B prime. But then we don't have to make any more copies, because we can atomically write a single block pointer to the new indirect block that we just wrote, and we don't have to copy to the root of this file and then up through the inodes and through their indirect pointers up to the root of the file system, eliminating so many copies. So this shows how we are able to short-circuit the shadow paging technique. This is one of the optimizations that you can use in short-circuit shadow paging to make it performant. Here's the next one. Where we're able to make in-place updates by taking advantage of our ability to write to very small amounts of memory atomically. So, for example, if we wanted to update a small portion of a file, maybe a metadata file or a data file, we can write those directly without making any copies. Another example would be if we want to write the new contents of a block, we'll write the new block, and then we can atomically switch the block pointer from the old to the new. Another example allows you to write larger updates, or updates that span multiple discontiguous addresses. And it takes advantage of the ability to atomically write 64-bit regions. And it exploits invariants about the data and the metadata in the file system. So, in this example, let's append 100 bytes to this block. The swap. So we can write the bytes into the unused portion of this block. If we were to crash at this point, we wouldn't see the new data. And so then we update the size of the file, which pulls in the new data atomically. And so again, we've not needed to make any copies to do this operation. So in these examples, and in all but one of the file system operations in BPFS, operations bubble up to at most the root of a particular file, never any further. There's one operation, the cross-directory name, which to find a common ancestor will have to bubble up above the root of a particular file. So the second point that I want to make with this example is that BPFS uses a simple tree data structure to track all of the resources that are in use by the file system. And by doing this, it means that there's at most, in exactly, one pointer to each resource. And this allows BPFS to take advantage of the small atomic writes that BPRAM provides us with to efficiently support these strong guarantees on the file system. So now I'm going to talk about the hardware changes that we have designed to allow short-circuit shadow paging take advantage of BPRAM in your PC. And let's do this by taking a look at the two problems you would have if you were to take BPRAM and put it into your memory slot on your PC and try to use it from software. And so we're going to take a look at how short-circuit shadow paging would work. So on this scroll, we have a list of the software instructions that we're going to execute. And in the green box, we have the contents of our CPU caches, and the purple box, the contents of BPRAM. So first, we're going to copy the data blocks in the indirect block that we want to commit. And after we've written the new versions of these, we atomically commit them by updating the pointer to them. Now, at some point, the cache controller is going to evict these dirty cache lines to BPRAM. And so let's say that it decides to evict the block pointer first. The problem here is if we were to now crash, we'd have an inconsistent file system, because the block pointer points to random garbage data. And so notice that here, the software wrote the new data in the correct order, but the cache controller reorders data to efficiently push updates to BPRAM or RAM in general. And so we need some mechanism, it seems, to convey the ordering of the allowed writes back to persistent memory. So let's rewind. Let's say that the cache controller did write the changes in the correct order. So it first writes our copy on write blocks. The next step is it's going to write this block pointer. But if it was writing the block pointer and then we lost power, we would only have part of the block pointer. And again, we'd have a corrupt file system. And so the problem here is that the writes are not atomic in the cache controller. And so we address both of these problems with two new primitives to hardware. And the first allows us to convey our ordering constraints to the memory system. So we've modified the CPU and the cache controller to implement a new primitive that we call epoch barriers that allow the CPU to say, any writes made after this barrier cannot be safely committed to persistent memory until all the preceding writes are committed to persistent memory. And in the paper's evaluation, we show that this is significantly faster than using, say, a write-through cache. I also want to note the analogy of epoch barriers with existing important hardware primitives. For example, SCSI's tag command queue for disk. We address the second problem by adding capacitors to DIMMs. And these allow writes to complete even after the loss of power. And these capacitors are simple and cheap because they only need to be very small, tens of nanojoules. So now let's take a look at this example again, but using these two new primitives to provide safety. So we write the new blocks. These ones indicate that these blocks are part of the first epoch. We'll then issue an epoch barrier, which increments the epoch count, so that any writes after this are part of the next epoch. And so when we issue the commit, it's part of epoch 2. Now at some point, the cache controller is going to evict pages and try to find something that is evictable. And we'll find that this block pointer is not yet evictable because there exist dirty cache lines as part of an earlier epoch. So it will have to first write those. And only after those are committed to persistent storage is it allowed to write the block pointer. And so now we have safely updated the file system. So this is from the point of view of how a single processor works. In the paper, we also talk about the details needed to make multiprocessors work. So now let's talk about how we've evaluated these changes. We have built and evaluated BPFS in a Windows in-kernel file system. And there are three parts to our evaluation. One, we experimentally evaluate BPFS on RAM, because we don't yet have PCM that we can plug into memory modules. And we compare this with NTFS on DRAM. We also simulate BPFS using our new epoch barriers, and in the paper show how this provides a significant performance advantage over using just, say, write-through memory. And then we combine the experimental and simulation results analytically to project how BPFS would perform on phase change memory. So let's start out in the experimental with these two micro-benchmarks. And so on the left here, you can see that we're pending some number of bytes per file for many terminals. Well, on the x-axis, you can see how many bytes we're pending. And along the y, you can see how long it takes to do this set of operations. Now, we have three lines here. The green one is NTFS running with a disk, and of course, with a DRAM buffer hash. The blue line is NTFS running on a RAM disk. And the red line is BPFS running with RAM instead of PCM. And so, and on the right, we have a similar operation where instead of appending, we write to random locations in the file. And so the results here, as you can see, are that BPFS is significantly faster than NTFS on disk and even NTFS on RAM. So BPFS is significantly faster than NTFS on disk. But you notice that it's, you know, maybe 4 or 10 times faster. That's because NTFS isn't issuing syncs to the file system. This is just a normal write. And so this data is not guaranteed to even be durable. But on BPFS, it is. And even compared to NTFS on a RAM disk, BPFS is significantly faster. And this is because BPFS doesn't have the overhead of writing so much data twice that the journaling overhead has in NTFS. And we see similar results for the random writes. So now we're going to take a look at one of the micro-benchmarks in the paper. We have several more there. And here we're going to take a look at the throughput of BPFS running on PCM. And we're doing this with the postmark benchmark. And so on the x-axis, we have four different configurations. NTFS running on a disk and a RAM disk, BPFS running on RAM, and a projected BPFS running on phase change memory. And along the y-axis, we have the execution time normalized to the execution time for NTFS on disk. So you can see that BPFS on phase change memory is faster significantly than NTFS on disk, and even NTFS on RAM disk, while at the same time providing stronger consistency guarantees. And so to show a little more detail, this is a projected value for how BPFS would work on PCM. And so on this right graph along the x-axis, we have the speed of phase change memory for, say, 100 to 800 megabytes a second. And along the y-axis, we have how long BPFS would take to do this benchmark if PCM ran at that speed. And so you can see here where the projected throughput for phase change memory runs, and that's the orange bar. So to conclude, BPRAM changes the trade-offs for storage. And we think we should use new consistency techniques that are designed for this medium to offer better performance and stronger consistency requirements. And short-circuit shadow paging does this, which is a significant advancement in the state-of-the-art in file systems and what they're able to provide to applications in the terms of performance and in consistency and durability. So, and a final note, we have a poster, and at the poster session, we'll actually have PCM chips that are decapped on hand if you want to check them out. So, thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions.
We're hiring, by the way. This is kind of cool stuff, and it's clear that, you know, file systems are about to change if this stuff becomes a viable replacement for disk. And there's certainly enough people who believe that it might well happen. It strikes me that, you know, what you're doing here is providing a facility that, over the fence in the database community, people have been looking at for a sort of long time. Because they've been doing it on disks and it's dog slow. So, is there a sense, do you feel there's a sense in which the storage requirements of a database and the storage requirements of a file system begin to converge somewhat when you have this kind of hardware available and it's no longer a disk?
So I'm going to answer your question. Let me know if I'm not quite answering it. So I think a number of our changes to the firmware that allow software to take advantage of this new types of memory will be just as applicable for other types of storage systems like databases. Does that answer your question? Or not quite?
It's sort of speculation. But
sure.
It's given that this is just doesn't look like disk anymore performance-wise, I'm just wondering if the way that you manage this for a database and the way you manage it for files are closer than you would if it was a disk. It's just a sort of
It might. I agree.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, let's take a question from the back, Mike, in the middle.
Is that better?
Yes.
Peter Desnoyers, Northeastern University. I'm very excited by this work. But I was wondering, here you're looking at something where you're still fitting exactly within the existing file system interface. Have you thought about ways that you could try to bring some of the more of the capability of this new medium to the application rather than just giving them sequential writes and sequential reads?
So I have thought about this some. I think the file system operations that we have today are as with many things, a large part of them come about from what is efficient to support. And so I suspect that you could very much change what types of operations, and by which I mean add types of operations, that file systems can efficiently support, prepending data or splitting data or I don't know, but lots of things. It also might be the case that you want to more directly expose phase change memory or other BPRAMs to applications. But a number of the advantages of these techniques and having the simple data structures might mean that file systems continue to be useful. Regardless, I think that by advancing the state-of-the-art here, making BPRAM accessible through the file system is useful in and of itself just because it allows all existing applications to take advantage of these kind of benefits, which is really nice.
Okay, how about Bill in the back here?
Okay, well, obviously for Microsoft Research. So when you showed the shadow paging example of adding a couple blocks to the file, you showed it short-circuiting by going up a couple levels to the point where it only had the right one pointer.
Right.
But what I don't understand is how you atomically deal with the free list of blocks or bytes or whatever.
Great question. So I didn't talk about this in the talk. We do talk about it at length in the paper. And so the answer is we don't have a free list. So there are a number of management data structures that you have in file systems today because that we are able to do away with because we're able to quickly scan the file system to rebuild these into non-volatile memory, where it's useful to have them still for quick access, say, what is the next free block? So we actually don't have to keep track of these data structures, and this means that the consistency guarantees we provide are much cheaper to do so.
And how much recovery costs do you have then?
So it's a read-only, it's not doing, say, an fsig. And for maybe a pretty full 8-gig file system, I think it takes parts of a second to mount the file system.
Okay, how about the person here?
This is Bill from IBM Research. Question got taken care of. Just an observation. Okay, is it on?
Yes.
Okay. Bill got my first question. As an observation, it's sort of formats your actual memory creating. But where do you go next for multiprocessors and clusters? That type gets a little tougher.
So one of the goals in designing this file system is that multiprocessors, so threads executing on different processors, can all be working concurrently on the file system and not being slowed down by each other. But I agree that there's probably a lot of interesting advantages that you could put in for multiprocessors and clusters that I haven't thought about.
So you talk about how you put a little capacitor in, then basically survive, and just probably turn it off.
Yep.
there a risk that the data that has been created in the computer is turned off, gets garbled, and is inviting the wrong contract?
So I don't remember these architectural details for that part. The other architects on the paper were the ones who did the most of this work. So I can't answer your question right now, but if you meet me afterwards, I'll figure this out in the chain.
I'm going to fish you a quote on the question from Microsoft about Microsoft.
Josh Triplett, Portland State University. I was wondering, the first thing that came to mind when you suggested all these consistency guarantees is what performance you're losing by having them. In particular, it seems like you're doing two things at once. You're creating a file system for this new bi-addressable persistent memory, and you're adding consistency guarantees. And effectively, you've said, well, we don't lose much performance by having them on this new medium, but could you go even faster by not having them, given that not all applications will necessarily need writes to complete in program order? Or for that matter, may not even need Atlassi.
Right. So there's some overheads to the guarantees that we provide. So the question is, what are those? And there's always a trade-off here between what guarantees do you have and what performance do you have. And this file systems take this, and today we have metadata journaling. That seems to be a generally useful trade-off. And so we think here that the trade-offs that we have chosen will be useful for BP memories, BP RAM memories. But I think that would definitely be an interesting question to look into, something I'm thinking about doing, just to know what you could do.
Brad? Hi, I'm Brad Chen from Google. First of all, really like the premise of needing a new kind of API for file access. I mean, these kind of RAM-like devices are very different from this, so I'm totally with you on that. I did have a couple of questions, though, about the experiments that she presented.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of related. The first is, she goes, if I wanted to make file I go really fast, I wouldn't need to read some writes, I would memory map the file and then move stuff there. I'm kind of concerned that none of the experiments, it appears that the experiments you use, none of them consider that way of doing file I/O. The other consideration I wanted to ask you to comment on was, it looked as though the hardware report you suggested you're kind of self-free, and I'm not sure I would buy that in particular. The stuff you're meddling with when LMNO2 cache flushes and such happens. Yeah, it seems like it could be expensive, so you just comment.
Yeah, so your first question was, can you give me a more quick sense so I can
remember?
Yeah. All right. So in our implementation, we've not yet implemented MMAP. And it's definitely something that would be interesting to do. So I agree that it would be interesting. What the file system interface provides over the MMAP interface would be the atomic operations. So from user space, if you were to write, say, a megabyte of data to a memory map file, it wouldn't commit atomically with the support that's there today. Whereas with our file system interface, if you call write 1 megabyte, it is committed atomically. So you get more guarantees that way, which might be useful. And then your second question was, you were worried about the performance of our changes to the caches. And so we evaluate these in the paper to look at interference and to look at the performance compared to, say, using a write-through cache, which would be another safe alternative. And they work very well there. But do you have questions beyond those, maybe?
Well, so I imagine there might be an impact on cycle time and CPU or something. The cache buses were the critical path.
For the file system operations that are performing?
For just CPU cycle time.
For unrelated software or for the file system?
Yeah, unrelated.
So one of the experiments in the paper looks at this, and we see that there's very little interference.
Okay, I think we have time for one last short question.
Okay. So one thing that bothers me about your evaluation pretty heavily is that you have this RAM-like storage structure that what you're comparing to data structures optimized for disk access. Why didn't you, for instance, benchmark against file system built on top of a B-tree where the block size is 64 bytes or something slightly larger, or compared to like even something as naive as a black tree, or maybe NetApp's writing more file logging system where the logs can be read faster now because it's random access. So why did you choose such a disoriented data structure instead of comparing to something more RAM-oriented that can take advantage of those random writes more effectively?
So is your question, why did we use the data structure that we did use for BPFS, or is it, why did we compare against NTFS?
Why did you compare against NTFS instead of something like B-tree optimized for the block size of PCM, for another file system, which is a log-optimized file system, but you get NKFS reads actions less necessary, something like that.
So we compared with NKFS, which is maybe the most widely used file system. And I think it would be interesting to compare against others, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's thank Chris again.
Thank you.